Tonight on Standing Room Only, The Garden of England.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
From May 31st to June 3rd, the Working Class Studies Association held their annual conference at Indiana University. Each day, there were several rounds of panels and speakers. On June 2nd, one of the panels focused on the working class deindustrialization in the UK. The panelists were Tim Strangleman, David Lendlingham, and Emma Pleasant, all from the University of Kent. Strangleman spoke first, presenting his research on changing employment in a Guinness brewery during the 20th century.
So I'm doing a paper that's from my project on Guinness, which is about to be a book, which hopefully this time next year will be here for you to buy. So what we wanted to do is talk about work decline, loss and change, and I'm using material from my research on Guinness, which dates back to 2004. And I want to use three vignettes to look at this idea of work decline, loss and change, and think about how people were embedded in their work and how that's kind of been questioned and people have been kind of disembedded. So I'll talk a bit about the project background so you've got some context and some scene setting. And then I'll use these three vignettes from the back end of the book, the last couple of chapters, to look about attachment and detachment through deindustrialization. And there are three kind of moments from some of the interviews that I've done. And I'm now conscious that the notes I wrote on this are all in pencil, which I can't read, so I'm just going to bask. Okay, so my project's been going since 2004, so it's a real tribute to an academic career when you can actually be doing something for quite so long. So if it comes out in 2018, that's 14 years of work. The closure of this plant, the Guinness factory, Guinness Brewery in Park Royal in West London, happened in 2005, and it was announced in 2004 when I was in the brewery for a different project. And I worked with a photographer, David McKayley, on an oral history and photographic project of the last 6 months of production. So it echoes if people are familiar. So but then I followed up with lots of archive, lots of oral histories with former workers. That's really disturbing the way that goes up and down. And what was revealed was a larger archive, especially a larger photographic archive. And you'll see some of those images here, and subsequently I got a British Academy grant to extend this, and then the wonderful book title that I'd come up with, Imagining Work in the 20th Century, and it's a longer title, has been rejected by Oxford University because they don't like that title. Okay, so for 70 years, Guinness were located all their production for mainland Britain in this huge factory, one of the biggest breweries, I think at one time it was the biggest brewery in the UK, in Park Royal in West London. And the buildings were designed by Giles Gilbert Scott, famous architect, and were in huge grounds. They deliberately built it in a garden, so I'm just trying to play with that idea of Garden of England. And they planted something like 2,000 trees, 3,000 shrubs. So they really laid this out in the parkland. But what you also created was this incredibly rich workplace culture and the visual record, and can't quite see that as well as it should be. Incredibly rich workplace culture grew up there, which I interviewed a lot of workers who'd been in this factory, some of them for 50 years, many for 40, and a number for 30. And this is reflected both in the oral histories, but also in the photographic and pictorial archive. So this is a painting of one of about five made in the 1950s of workplace culture in Park Royal, and this is the Cooper ceremony. So this is one of the apprentice Coopers coming out of his time. So he's just about to be thrown in this barrel. Fucking Jack has to walk in just when I'm talking about Coopers. He's going to give me some
time. Don't forget the Coopers.
Yeah, don't forget the Coopers. Okay, I'm going to change that now. So the photographic record is absolutely stunning, and I've talked about the way it kind of reflects lots of ideas about workplace culture. So what I'm trying to do is lay the foundation of a really stunning, rich, embedded workplace culture, which I've captured both in the use of visual imagery as well as in the oral histories. And then fast forward to 2004-2005, and what you've got is a workforce that's kind of just on the point of losing their jobs. So it's a very rich time to do an oral history about workplace culture, because I've talked in the book about the way this is a breaching experiment. So previously taken for granted ideas about work suddenly are thrown into contrast. They're made problematic by the fact that workers are just about to lose their jobs. So what you've got here, the photographer wanted to capture all the workers on shift at any one time. So what you've got here is a shift, where previously there'd been 1,500, sometimes 2,000 workers. They wouldn't have all been there at one time, but this is the blue-collar crew for one sort of 12-hour shift. So you've got a real reduction in workers anyway, but you've got an absolute on shift at any one time. But I mean, if I give you three vignettes, the first one is Dave's story. Dave was one of those people that you just saw. Dave's a really interesting guy. So he's confronted with losing his job. And he's got two sons, both of whom went to university. And he's this guy who's done 40 years in the brewery. He's really embedded in his work. But now he's having to confront of losing his job. And he's been through several rounds of redundancy. So this has been... his identity as a worker has been kind of chipped away. So he's kind of letting it go now. But what's interesting is his sons who've gone to university, and both have trained as engineers. So he talks about one of his sons, his experience. His son, I suppose, is the same as mine, a bit earlier. He did 11 years in Nestle, and they've been doing almost what we've been doing here, is cutting numbers year after year. So he was made redundant in February this year. We talked about it a fair bit because Nestle, again, even then was a culture you joined the company and you're not quite stayed forever, but you're in and that was it. So he's got one kid who's trained as an engineer at university, gone in, done 11 years, and he really sort of proud of his kid for keeping at it. But then he's made redundant, not 40 years into a job, but 11 years in. His other son got the degree and then kept moving about, wouldn't stay put, wouldn't. And he's saying, I'm really critical of this other son. He's then having to reevaluate not only his son's identities, but his own, because he's been made redundant. But his son, who's been moving around, turns out he may have the right attitude to work because he's not being caught up in redundancy. He's making active choices. So it's a kind of existential discussion about the nature of work and commitment and embeddedness. So the one son embeds himself after 11 years, gets kicked out, gets made redundant as Dave had himself. The other son, who chooses to do a job for 18 months, then go travelling back to another one, Dave's been critical of his son all the way through that process, and yet now he's looking at his son thinking, well, you know what, he probably had the right attitude, but he still wants to keep something back. He still wants to applaud his other son who worked for Nestlé, Sardis Rhee. So yes, I've had quite long conversations with him, but one of the things I've tried to encourage them to do is not quite get stuck in the groove. Robert has now been forced to think about that because he was made redundant from Nestlé. With Stephen, it's the other thing. I wish he would stay a little longer in each company. But yes, we talk about work, we talk about redundancy. So there's this sort of sense that I wish he'd attach himself, I wish he'd embed himself, but you know what? Perhaps he shouldn't. And it's this kind of dialogue. So the second vignette I talk to workers a lot about the impending closure, but my research was actually in talking to workers before the plant was closed down and then pulled down. But then I talked to another worker who'd actually been made redundant 10 years before the plant closed. So this is Terry. So Terry's interesting. So he worked in the plant for 20 years, gets made redundant, very, very committed to it, and he travels up to Park Royal from the south coast of England. So about two and a half hours to go and photograph the plant when it's being pulled down. So Terry says, so I ask him, why did you do that? Why did you go and photograph a plant that you hadn't worked in and you'd been made redundant from 10 years before? So he says, curiosity, I suppose. I can't help but go back there. You worked there all those years and it's funny. I wouldn't go back and see Lancet's, that's his former workplace, the car place, be demolished. And they did demolish that building. No, it's something about the brewery, the people in it, the work, the camaraderie. Of all the people you worked with, you couldn't help but go back. It's almost the last tribute. And he goes on, and I'm asking about what he feels about it, why he did this. And he said, I was very saddened by that, and this is the pulling down of the building. I was a bit angry in some ways because I thought they were going to, and he breathes deeply, use a bit of it for maybe a brew house as a museum. I went up there during that time and they're demolishing the place, and there was a bit of lump in the old throat job. You're looking at this poor old building, the way you see it, and you can see all the floors. I've got the picture here, and you can see all the floors, and you say, oh, that's where I stood, that's where I stored the bucket there. And his interview was full of recounts of being water fights they used to have, so they used to drench each other in water. So he said, God, it was sad. It was very sad. So again, another vignette into a sense of embeddedness. This is someone, I must emphasise, who hadn't worked in this place for 10 years, but when he hears it's being pulled down, he travels. Cost him a lot of money to get up there, and he photographs a place he used to work. So the final example of embeddedness is, I'm trying to capture moments of embeddedness and how you might think about this. So before the building was pulled down, but after it was closed, it was a subject of urban exploration. So spelunkers, urban explorers got in. And one was a very famous one from Belgium, who explored it. And people like Steve Hyde, for example, are very critical of urban explorers. They think it's doing disrespect to working class places of employment. But I looked up, I knew about this website, Forbidden Places. They've got about 20 odd pictures of Park Royal on there. And it's still up there. And I revisited it just before I wrote this final chapter. And I was interested to see what they kind of done with it. I had seen it at the time. But what amazed me and really pleased me for the purposes of the book was that there'd been a huge amount of comment on it. And what this had done, this putting up of pictures before the buildings were pulled down, was it had created this kind of space for memory about having worked in there. And it was both workers who'd worked in there, but also family members of deceased workers who went back and who solicited memories about the place and also about the contemporary nature of work. So this is one guy, and he said, so he's looked at these pictures and he's left a comment on the website. He said, you joined the company in the summer of 74. I went into the boys' scheme, which was the sort of scheme for 16-year-old pre-adult workers, which meant over a two-year period you got to work a month or two at a time in many of the departments in the brewery. What an eye-opener that was for a still wet behind the ears boy of 16. Guinness as an employer is fantastic. Good pay, free pensions, free food and beer, brilliant sports club and social scene. Plus the company had a real family feel to it. It was like a little world of its own. It's very sad to see the pictures now and bring back so many great memories. Mostly, though, you remember the people and the characters you worked with and met. And there were some really good stories to tell about this place and the people in them. But I'd be here at least a week if I went into all of them. I think this is another worker said, I can't help think that companies nowadays would benefit by taking the approach Guinness did to their employees and still make good profits as Guinness did. Although there were close to 1,500 people working there when I started, everyone seemed to know everyone else, and including the directors. I remember getting into the lift one day in the malt store not long after I started, and a chap got in who I didn't know. He asked me my name and then went on to explain he knew my father, who was still working in the brewery at the time. It turned out to be Edward Guinness, who was one of the Guinness family who worked as a manager in the brewery. So my point is here that you've got two examples there in this third vignette of memory about embeddedness, about workplace culture, being exhumed through the use of photography. So just to sort of wrap up, what I've tried to do there is talk about, the book is really a kind of meditation on how we think about work and how we can think about what work used to give us and how that may have changed over time. So I'm trying to pack a lot in, but I've talked about deindustrialization as a more general process, as this idea of a breaching experiment. So breaching experiment, and sociologists in the room will know, it's when you deliberately do something that breaches a norm in order to see what reaction you get from people. So the classic example would be if you took something off a shelf in a supermarket and put it in someone else's trolley, or took something out of someone's trolley. So it breaches a norm, norms of patterns of behaviour. So deindustrialization acts as that breaching experiment. It takes people from their day-to-day world of work and starts to allow them to reflect, however brutally, about what work was and what it meant to them. So that loss of work gives pause for reflection. So you think, well, what did I value about work? What did I like about it? What was going on there? What subtlety was going on? And several people have been kind of quite critical of what they see as this kind of fixation on the rust belt and rust belt jobs, and talked about smokestack nostalgia. So Jeff Cowie has coined that phrase, as far as I know, smokestack nostalgia. And I'm interested in it because one of the first conference papers I ever gave, someone stood up and told me I was being nostalgic, simply because I was finding value in working class jobs. And it's always been very useful for me to think in those sorts of way, because nostalgia is far more complex than people often mean when they use that phrase pejoratively. And I think this kind of idea of embeddedness and disembedding and breaching experiment allows you a critical appraisal. The workers who are reflecting on their time at work, those three vignettes I've shown you, each in their different ways is being critical of work and their workplace. They're not saying back in the day it was brilliant, although that is the text in one of those quotes again. But there's a kind of critical thinking, well, what was good about it and what's been lost, what is lost through that process. And I think what my work's trying to do, and the Guinness book is attempting to do, is make sense of that industrial culture. And I talk in the book about industrial citizenship, which I think for a time, especially in the post-war period, for that 30 years from, say, 1947, 48, 49, through to about 1973, 74, this was certainly in Britain as good as it gets for blue-collar workers in terms of permanency of work, decent conditions, not by no means perfect. What the back end of my book does is look at from the process from 1980 onward, even those workers with full-time jobs are subject to a whole series of erosions of their workplace. The worker I first quoted there, Dave, had gone through something like four rounds of redundancy and having to reapply for his job. And I asked him, you know, are you going to miss working here? And he said, If you'd asked me that 5 years ago, I would have said yes. But he just felt like he'd been through enough now, and he just wanted to let it go. And I in the book I talk about, it's almost as if Dave and others there had been, they had a grip on their work in earlier years, and it gradually, over the sort of 1980s, 1990s, their fingers had gradually been pulled away from that grip. So they're left with the sense that they can walk away from something without a great attachment to it, because they're no longer embedded in that. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I am going to introduce a little bit about the Garden of England. As Tim said, he wasn't really expecting to be on a panel, so this, in many ways, is the first bit of the Garden of England bit. I did a project over the last 2 years, and this is its first outing in presentations, about a former shipyard in the town of Faversham in Kent. And I did a whole series of oral histories with former shipyard workers, and also a series of interviews with campaigners who are trying to bring industry and work back to the sites around this former shipyard. So the talk is called Deindustrial Displacement. I'm going to talk about a number of kinds of displacement, remembering and reinventing a shipbuilding past. And I'm always interested in the crossover between deindustrialization and its study and other ideas of memory and heritage. Often books, primarily about heritage, use sites of deindustrialization as case studies through which to explore the nature of memory, how we practice heritage, institutionalize it, who gets left behind, who gets involved. And inevitably, with deindustrialization studies, it's a process of change, it's a process that also considers the kind of cultural aspects as well as the economic, one that thinks about the ongoing fate of communities, of class identities, well beyond the closure of an industry. What happens to those places, what happens to those people? Memory and heritage inevitably feature in so many of those. But a lot of what also comes out of this crossover in this literature is that industrial identities are often used, they're utilised, particularly in heritage practices. How a place is remembered, how people are remembered, how types of work are remembered, are very useful to the communities trying to protect their identities during processes of social change. They're very useful to political and commercial concerns who want to exploit some aspect of a working identity. Bella Dix famously talks about the laborist imaginary, for example, the idea of sort of former coalfield areas in South Wales and the sort of labor movement history of that and how those get utilized to try and sell the place for redevelopment. And Tim did some work on other aspects of this. And also about changing representations of what industrial even means. And that is the focus I'm going to be doing here. An idea of modernity and progress, industry once representing that, and then industry coming to represent the outdated, the polluted, the past. Kent is down here. It's closer to France here than it is to what are usually considered the industrial heartlands of the UK, South Wales, Scotland, the North, the Midlands. And it has this reputation for agriculture, for being the Garden of England, rolling hills, orchards, all of this kind of stuff. But as with many places that don't fit into that kind of heartland narrative, it had industry, and it had lighter industries and craft industries, but it also had heavy industries. It had steelmaking, shipbuilding, coal mining, which we'll hear about tomorrow in the follow-up session, munitions, oil refining. And these were industries that defined those places for generations. So this idea of the Garden of England is a problematic one in the sense that already it sort of displaces industry in and of itself in the memory. Now this is Faversham itself, and I want to show you this because it's a tiny town. You will probably have never heard of this place. It certainly isn't known for its shipbuilding past, though it had it. But also, it's a weird place. It's got a population of just around 19,000 people now. This is all marshland. Undeveloped marshland, and then this is Faversham Creek. It's a very narrow, winding, difficult to navigate tidal creek that silts up the moment you don't touch it for like a week. It's really not a very good place to have a shipyard. And down here, you've just got countryside, rural villages, orchards. So this is a very kind of unusual place. And it's unusual, too, in that what this geography forced the shipyard to do was launch its ships in a particular way. For its size, the busiest shipyard in the country, but a weird one. This should never have been a shipyard. The geography is all wrong, and this sideways launch is a very rare thing. I've heard of one other shipyard in Northern Ireland that used this. There may be others people know about, but this is what it forced them to do. Now, why is there a shipyard there? Well, it was built originally for extra capacity during the middle of World War I. For building transport ships mainly, rather than warships, but transport ships, because of its proximity to London, it's just around a short sail to London, but also to Dover. And Dover in the UK is the access point to continental Europe. In its time, and it only lasted for just over 50 years, it built 1,000 ships, all big steel tankers for transporting goods and other materials, and it also tried to build 2 concrete ships, which sank. Which I always like the idea of what would happen to the concrete ships, which now are breakers in the Thames estuary. So that's interesting. But it was there for 50 years, and in that 50 years, it dominated employment in the town. It became the main employer for men in the town, provided apprenticeships programs, and I found situations where, from some of the people I interviewed, where sort of two generations, father and son, had ended up going into this. It doubled the population of the town by the 1950s, and also reshaped it. Faversham used to exist on one side of the creek, and the other side of the creek where the shipyard was developed, also a modern housing estate grew where all the shipyard workers lived, and it doubled that size, and also created a really interesting demographic split. There was literally one side of the creek and the other side of the creek, which I'll say a bit more about in a second. But in 1970 it closed. And there are a number of different reasons that some of the workers who were there at closure or were working near the creek at closure gave for this. And it says something about the complicated nature of this narrative. Peter Maxey, who was a welder for 20 years at the shipyard, said, Marshall Pollock, he was the son of James Pollock, the original founder. He died about that time, a nephew of his took over, and he wasn't very good at it. This nephew was more interested in collecting classic cars than he was in investing anything in the company. They didn't invest in new technologies, very quickly became outcompeted. Phil Ellis, who took over from the incompetent nephew, and he was a chief draftsman who then became the last director, said, our trade finished about the same time as the creek, because the creek had been silting up for years and nothing had ever been done about it. The geography finally caught up with them without the investment. And Gordon Baker, who was an engineer on an oil transport ship, an oil tanker called the BP Haulier, which was built at Faversham, and there was also an oil depot further up the creek as well, said the biggest thing that changed it all was the M25, motorways. Transport of goods by road meant that this place at the end of a tiny narrow waterway, which wasn't connected well by road, suddenly becomes a backwater. It becomes obsolete. So it died as a shipyard in 1970 because it was outcompeted and poorly situated. And what I find interesting is this is long before the mass deindustrialisations of the 1980s, the highly politicised and the sort of crushing of UK industry and the labour movement generally that occurs in the 1980s. And in that sense, it very much kind of lacks the political capital of the fights that come after that.
You have been listening to The Garden of England, on Standing Room Only, on WFHB. You've been listening to David Nettlingham present his research, Deindustrial Displacement, Remembering and Reinventing a Shipbuilding Past. He was the second of 3 speakers in the Working Class Cities Association conference panel called Work, Decline, Loss, and Change, Exploring Working Class Deindustrialization in the Garden of England. We now return to the show with the rest of David Nettlingham's presentation of Deindustrial Displacement, Remembering and Reinventing a Shipbuilding Past.
Also, the idea of it's outside of Labour heartlands, it's in Tory country, it's Conservative voting, this is a rural constituency. It lacks the sort of the Labour idea as well. Equally, there were many re-employment opportunities in 1970 for skilled workers at a shipyard nearby, including where Emma's going to talk about in a minute. So for individual workers, this wasn't the devastating blow that a lot of the mass deindustrialisation of the 80s would be. But what it did do was it did become devastating for the town. The communities dispersed, employment became very limited in Faversham, and it really sort of dies as a town. To the point where when I was a kid, I grew up not far from here, and we just didn't go to Faversham. There was nothing there. There was absolutely no reason to go to Faversham. But today, there is a campaign, or a number of campaigns, that are trying to get to that kind of industrial heritage and use it to do a number of things. First of all, to bring back active maritime work to the creek, to say, this is what we do as a town, and so we should continue to do this, including things like apprenticeships. To increase community ownership and influence in the regeneration process, currently it's mostly being, or has been, housing developments that have occurred on former shipyard site and things like this, so they want to stop it just being about developers and bring the community aspect back, and also to boost tourism through working identities, and tourism is a huge part of how they think they're going to use work. And there's two primary organisations. One is the Faversham Creek Trust. You'll notice this ship here. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a minute. They are, for want of a better phrase, gentrifiers. They're on the old medieval side of the creek. They are mostly people who live in quite large houses on one of the main strips that runs down the centre of Faversham. A lot of them lived in London and then sold up and then moved down. Whereas the Brents Community Association, which doesn't even have a logo, that's how low-key it is there to protect the people on the Brents, which is the big housing estate that was built to house the shipyard workers. And they have very different competing interests in this. But they too use this ship here. Now these are Thames sailing barges. They were built specifically to take things around, out in and out of London and around the east coast of the UK. And Faversham was a place where these ships were sometimes built and also where they ran in and out of. But the thing is, these are 19th century industrial technologies. By the time of the early 20th century in the shipyard, no one was building these, and they were already starting to go out of use because much bigger and better steel tankers and things like this were being used. So these Thames sailing barges now, which are quite beautiful to watch with the red sails and things like this, become the rallying cry for these different organisations. And one of the arguments I want to make in this paper, and because it's its first outing, any suggestions and criticisms are very welcome, is that what is happening in these campaigns is that industry and the industrial legacy of the shipyard is being used to say, look, we were a shipyard town, this is what we do, it's what we do well, it's part of the nature of the town. But also, modern heavy industry is written out of this narrative. We've sort of skipped back in time. And you can see this in some of the interviews I did with the campaigners from both organisations. People talking about the shipyard, it kept the town alive, so there's a lot of interest in keeping that tradition. There's a lot of life and death stuff comes through in these narratives. When we first came here in 1986, the shipyard was still, it wasn't an active shipyard. If you've got a waterway like this with historic value, as soon as you build houses, you can't have maritime use again. Directly tying the housing development and the problems of the housing development and stopping maritime use to the shipyard past. And Brian Borman, who was actually a welder at Pollock Shipyard and then went on to work for the Faversham Creek Trust, which is interesting. He's one of the few locals who's part of it, or who grew up there, rather. The old shipyard, now that is houses have been put along there, the Creek Trust would like to see some industry in these places, bring industry and keep industry. But the industry that ends up being talked about is slightly different. And I'm saying there's a sort of rewriting of what industry means for the sake of the campaigns. Mike Maloney, who's a filmmaker, who didn't realise his house was on the site of the former shipyard for 3 years. he managed to live there on the creek side, enjoying his water views, and didn't realise there was even a shipyard there. Finally became aware of it and made some films about the creek. He said, you won't have sideways launches again, but there is a kind of feeling that we should bring some of the glory days back. Sailing barges. Sailing barges are the glory days. I think that's what people come to see. They want history. And Sue Ackhurst, who is actually the chair of the Faversham Creek Trust right now, says, We could have business there. We could have actual real activity. Tourists would come and stand and they would look at people working on the barges. I have a whole other paper about people being looked at on barges that I'm working on at the same time and whether that's what they want or not. And you can see it in the promotional material for the campaigns too. This is their vision of the creek. It's emphasising very much the kind of rural aspects. You have the Thames sailing barges in those two there, and the whole town is being sold on the idea of these Thames sailing barges there. And it's an industrial image. These were industrial transport craft, but it's the right kind of industrial transport. And they're beautiful, and a lot of the promotional material is about attracting traditional, beautiful boats back to the town, as if that's what the town had before. It was just a place for beautiful boats to sit more and be looked at. And I've got two arguments, really, that I'm trying to make in the paper that I'm hoping to write about this, about the sort of the idea of tradition and modernity that comes out of what's happening in Faversham, and potentially what it means for smaller sites in particular that exist outside of the narratives of the usual narratives of deindustrialisation or industrial heartland, and why Kent is quite an important place for this. The first is that you see a shift from industrial modernity to tradition in the language of how these places are remembered. So heavy industry gives way to traditional boat building, and even the apprenticeships that they're doing now, they're building small wooden craft, and it's carpentry. Of course, carpentry was in the shipyard, as it would have been. But the idea of kind of, you know, the riveters and all of this kind of, and the welders, they disappear from the narrative. Steel and concrete give way to wood. And also the idea of modernity as progress gives way to a kind of timeless beauty that you can shift back to the 19th century, and that represents what the town is all about today, as it was then, as it has always been. Even if they were actually producing things like this, rather than things like this, for most of the 20th century. And the second argument that I'm putting forward is that what this does is it places the role of heritage practices on these smaller sites as deindustrializing processes in themselves. They help to remove the memory of industry, and they help to sort of change the trajectory of the town away from the memories of those people. So the workers' stories tend to disappear. And this is true of all of the... If you go into the museum in the town, the shipyard is mentioned very, very briefly, but there's no... There's sort of a couple of images just because they're a bit interesting. But the actual shipyard part has kind of got disappeared. So in sites that are displaced in time, it was too early to be caught up in the 1980s, in place, it's in Kent, it's in the wrong place, it's also in a really stupid place to put a shipyard for any length of time, which is why it died. But also in then discourse, industrial discourses about where is industrial and where industrial workers lived and worked, but also in heritage discourses. And that this is part of the cultural and representational process of industrial loss. This is part of what makes deindustrialization a cultural process. It's this kind of language loss, the unappealing modernity of it. So, thank you very much.
I am actually Tim and David's PhD, so you might notice a little bit of a crossover happening. Haven't we got too much? So what I want to do today is kind of come along the same kind of themes that David and Tim have introduced. And I want to show you why I believe recent calls across the UK and the US to revitalise craft apprenticeships seem so appealing to communities of lost industry, but why ultimately restoring the teaching of practical skill alone is not going to be enough to restore the value that these communities were once able to share in. And I want to do this by introducing you to another part of Kent, which is my hometown, Chatham. Now, my maps are really bad compared to David's, so I'm sorry. But this roughly where Kent is. So Chatham is located in the southeast of England. It's part of a collection of towns known as Medway. Chatham and its neighbour Gillingham were once largely made up of dockyard and naval buildings, as you can see by the crude blue outline there. So it was a royal dockyard town for over 600 years, and in 1984 the yard was closed at the expense of over 10,000 local jobs. Today Chatham and Medway suffer from high levels of unemployment at documented rates well above national and local averages. Now, attempts to revitalise the area have been aimed at turning parts of the dockyard into a naval heritage museum, creating a heritage narrative that Laura Jane Smith refers to as an authorised heritage discourse. So the focus is kind of on these marketable naval stories of military success at the expense of the everyday workforce, who obviously made up life at Chatham. So this has left the people of Medway isolated from their own histories, reinforcing the social and cultural losses that have been felt from the 80s. So my research over the last 2 years has been aimed at collecting the histories of the former workers and young people involved in craft apprenticeships today to try and understand the lived experiences of industrial loss when it comes to apprenticeships and the effect that this has for the working class of Medway today. Now my focus has kind of shifted onto apprenticeships particularly because, I mean, as we know, they offered working class boys in particular a sort of route to legitimate employment and pride for centuries. And at Medway 2, it allowed, as a former tug worker, Mark Collier, said to me, it gave the people of Medway something that they would have never otherwise had. Now, before I go any further, I want to introduce you to another participant of mine, Stuart Pollitt, who was an electrical engineer at Chatham Dockyard. So what Stuart is reflecting on here, then, is a loss and an invisibility, but something much more than the loss of a practical skill. He's reflecting on something much less tangible, which I argue is the social aspect of skill, the cultural character which had once allowed the workers to find value in their craft skill identity. He identifies that the passers-by are missing something and that it's important that they know what he knows. This is because he's not just talking about the work that was lost, but he's talking about the experiences and the pride that they afforded him from the age of 16. Stuart is very proud of his craft skill identity, and he recognises that there's been a breakage in his ability to pass on that pride. So as Stuart stands in the frame, he creates an association with himself and the material memory of his work as he reflects on how both have been stripped of their histories. The skeleton frame remains as it is because of its status as a listed building, because the architecture was used as a replica for a famous London train station. But this just highlights more tensions of, well, what is to be done with this frame? And as Stuart and the other former workers see it, what is to be done with their legacy? So what I want to do for the rest of the paper today, then, is to show you how, I believe, through the story of this skeleton machine shop, we can understand how apprenticeships in the past, the present, and the future are kind of manifesting, and the impact this has for the workers today. So as I'm talking about these kind of pursuits of value for working class identities, I've been influenced by the works of Beverly Skeggs and Steph Lawler and how they can kind of conceptualise these pursuits of working class value. So I'm understanding value as pursuits for legitimacy and identities that are often opposed to or subversive of middle class norms. So to understand how work identities in particular help with these pursuits of value, I've developed an understanding of a craft skill identity that could have provided a framework for legitimacy. This craft skill and pursuits of value at work, well documented in literatures on industrial cultures, working class cultures, in particular Randy Hodgson's book Dignity at Work, where he talks about the potential for high levels of disaffection in working class labour because it's manual, it's dirty, it's not very nice, it's hard work. So creating these kind of frameworks of legitimacy becomes even more important in these settings. So he looks at how individuals use cultural inversion techniques at work to create boundaries of the other, to form frameworks in which their cultural values are legitimate. So through these kind of frameworks, workers were able to feel pride in their craft, like Simon here. This certificate was shown to me by Simon, a former shipwright, almost 40 years after he left the yard. Now this certificate was issued to all apprentices to demonstrate something particular, that they belong to a group of skilled craftsmen. So the certificate becomes a marker, almost like an ID card of membership to a certain craft skill culture or identity. Simon kept this for this amount of time because it's meaningful to him. It demonstrates a character of his craft skill, suggesting it's more than just a qualification, but it has a social meaning to it. So this to me then says that there's a duality to what it is to be skilled. Now, when the machine shop was open and the craft identity was able to flourish, this craft skill identity, the social side of skill, was able to flourish alongside it. Now, in The Craftsman, Richard Sennett spoke of skilled identities as having this kind of dual nature too. So he spoke of these skilled identities as being intrinsic to craft work, as they entail a physical capability to produce a higher standard of product and a socially constructed disposition. Now, this skilled identity at the Dockyard too required both the practical display of technical knowledge, they were constantly put under examination throughout their time there, and a social recognition, which was developed through the relationship between skipper and apprentice. Now, both of these things were achievable through accessing a shared community of knowledge. Now, Catherine Dudley highlights in her study of the deindustrializing, probably a word I should know how to say by now, car parts factory in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that workers have built up across generations a pool of knowledges that were both formal and informal, which allowed the workers to complete the job to both a higher standard and at a faster pace. So these tricks of the trade were both shortcuts, but they also formed a more ephemeral component in that a certain disposition was shared, which allowed the workplace to be negotiated. So by accumulating these knowledges through the medium of other workers, the individual is investing in a shared community of both the past, the present, and the future, as workers acquire shared knowledges, implement them, and adapt them to be passed along to future generations. So these kind of processes develop frameworks such as the craft skill identity, whereby the cultural norms shared were valued as they were operationalized through the work process and legitimized by the dominant order of the occupational community. Now, this process is something that I've come to understand as cultural bridging. So cultural bridging is a conceptual tool to help us understand how these work identities are transmitted in pursuits of value. As such, it's a conversation that ties together both the past, the present, and the future, allowing for cultural norms to be shared across generations, establishing frameworks that allow these identity-informing factors to be legitimized and thus valued, whether it be formally or informally. So through cultural bridging, the cultural norms are transmitted via the community of skill, creating a sphere, the craft skill identity, in which workers can find value. So what happens then when the industry is removed? Now, like the machine shop, apprenticeships have been systematically stripped of funding, opportunities, and value. And with this has come the removal of those communal occupational cultures and craft skill identities that once gave opportunity for the working class to attain value in their cultural norms. Through Anoop Nayak's exploration of deindustrial Newcastle, we can see the disruptive potential of deindustrialization to the cultural codes of young working class men who are left with what can be termed as cultural fallout, to borrow the kind of metaphoric language of Sherry Lincoln's Half-Life. So they're left with these scattered remnants of an industrial hegemonic masculinity that litters their identities as memories of their inherited past, which only serves to cloud the legitimate employment opportunities and pursuits of value. So by embodying these traits without the framework to find value in them, the men were facing a crisis of craft skill, as they had no schema in which to attain value and meaning. So accessing these shared communities of craft skill can only be successful when the frameworks are allowed to reproduce intergenerationally. Now, this is the loss that Stuart is starkly aware of. The loss of the ability to reproduce the frameworks that once gave pride in their craft skill identity. Cultural bridging then has been broken. So the ability to reproduce these frameworks intergenerationally is frozen because, as Stuart shows us, the pride that was once held is now invisible. So like the skeleton machine shop, the basic framework of apprenticeships remains, but they're devoid of the cultural legitimacy that they once shared, which directly devalues the identity to the workers themselves, as they can no longer find pride in their craft through cultural bridging. So displayed here is the plans for the redevelopment of the leisure centre, of the machine shop, sorry. It's going to be a leisure centre, a very sort of glaring green leisure centre. So it's going to maintain its frame, but have a new model for Medway's economy placed upon it. So what can we know about this then from apprenticeships today? So I've been working with two organisations that train apprentices. One is a car parts factory that train a very small amount of in-house apprenticeships. And the other is a larger, the sort of like a college, I suppose. And they do quite a large amount of craft apprenticeships, and they teach them and supply the apprentices to local industries. So like the machine shop, there have been attempts to put this kind of new model on an old frame. And consistently, both these organisations receive bad Ofsted results. Ofsted is the UK's governmental organisation that inspect and rate educational programmes. So both organisations have attempted to change and improve upon their programmes based on both what Ofsted want to see, but also what the apprentices want and the apprentices are going to need when they get into their workplaces. But importantly, they recognise these to be dichotomous ideologies. So like the frame, apprenticeships today are told they have no place in the new economy and need to be remodeled. But this affects the apprentices themselves, who repeatedly share in the narrative that one day they'll do a proper degree, reinforcing the idea that their training paths are illegitimate. So in comparison to Stuart and Simon, they're not able to find the same level of pride and value in their craft skill identity. Now this distinction tells us that Stuart and Simon had a very different experience with pretty much the same kind of training. they attained the qualifications but were able to utilise them within a framework that valued them. So they're able to feel some kind of pride in their craft skill identity. But for the apprentices today who do not have access to the same narratives of legitimacy, they do not feel that same kind of pride. But nevertheless, the frame remains. They're still learning the same sorts of practical skills that the dockyard workers learn and are often being taught by that generation of workers. There's a lot of crossover with former dockyard workers teaching apprentices now, or people from similar sort of industries in the area that closed roughly around the same sort of time. But this just causes more tensions with Ofsted, because these former workers don't have any formal educational training, and instead they try to impart their skills in the same way that they were imparted onto them, but under these new conditions. So there exists a tension between the craft skill community and, to borrow the kind of phrasing of Laura Jane Smith, this authorised educational discourse that values these generalisable test results over the ability to be autonomous in one's work practices. So, like the authorised heritage discourse that we see at the Dockyard Museum, there's normative middle-class ideologies are being imposed upon a working-class cultural sphere, which just blocks these opportunities for value. So Ofsted want them to do these kind of tests and coursework that are more sort of on level with, I suppose, a high school diploma. But that means that when they're going into their workplaces, they don't know these kind of tricks of the trade to be able to negotiate the workplace properly. So Stuart stood at that skeleton building then. He's reflecting on much more than the loss of a practical skill. He's reflecting on the loss of a culture, the loss of a social character of craft skill that is not able to thrive under the conditions of the post-industrial economy. For those workers and current apprentices alike, this is not just a case of the mere outdating of skill. It's about the devaluation of an identity that provided legitimacy and pride for generations of workers, for their fathers, their uncles, their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers. So the dockyard workers like Stuart and the apprenticeship teachers feel a responsibility. They were ingrained into the community of craft skill and had the expectation to pass it on in the same way that it was to them. They feel like they've broken this craft skill community, and throughout their narratives lies a sense of guilt, but not of a broken spirit. They desire to pass this on in some way, whether it be through attempts to engage with heritage or to battle with Ofsted to be teachers. And this is because they recognise this sharing of cultural norms to be important. They're starkly aware of this devaluation of apprenticeships and the effect that this has on the working class boys and girls of today, but they're not content to let that be. So as Stuart stands remembering, he remembers the pride that was afforded to him at the age of 16 and the invisibility of that pride today. Not just a craft skill pride, but a wider working class pride that's been stripped from the community of Medway and many others like it. So what can we know overall then from this frame? As we all know, there's been a shift in the type of work deemed valuable, and the economic losses of this in Medway have been well documented. However, by looking through the eyes of Stuart as he reflects on his lost industry, we can learn something more about the everyday experiences of this loss. We learn that there was once a thriving intergenerational community that were able to culturally bridge their craft skill identities to create frameworks of value for the working class. Something that Catherine Dudley refers to, the knowledges of work that simply cannot be taught but need to be experienced and accessed through socialisation with others who hold ownership of this craft skill identity. And we learn that this loss is ongoing, and it has effect for the working class of today who try to follow in these career paths. And we know that more than it just being old boy syndrome, as Stuart terms it, there's an importance to remembering the social character of work. So as demonstrated by these pictures of apprentices at work, this was given to me by a participant. It's an apprentice working with an ADZE, which I must admit I have no idea what that is. And the other one is a picture that I took of a multi-skilled engineering apprentice who, again, is doing these kind of more blanketable qualifications. We can see that the practical side of skill remains largely unchanged. But through Stuart's remembering and the craft skill community that the skeleton frame represents, we're able to see the degradation of working class respectability. So for the young working class of today who aspire to one day do a proper degree, they're unlikely to share in this same value that allows Stuart and Simon to still draw pride from it 40 years later. And I want to quickly show you one other example that kind of reinforces the point. Now, this is another participant of mine, Mark Collier. He isn't an apprentice. He was a worker on the tugs. I mentioned him briefly earlier. And so he has no practical formal skill, essentially. But he worked for 3 years with people who had these apprenticeships and had these formal skills. And he was socialised into this. He picked up these kind of skills, these kind of these tricks of the trade in the same way as Catherine Dudley talks about. Now, when the dockyard closed, he took this flag off of his tug collie. And unfortunately, when Mark left the yard, he was homeless for a number of years. And he was telling me the story of when he was homeless and he was on the street and he kept this flag with him and he wrapped it around himself. And it was a reminder for him of a time when he had pride. And it was a time when he was able to feel some kind of dignity in his identity. So this just kind of reinforces the point I'm trying to make, that this social aspect of skill is so important that restoring just the practical teaching is not going to do anything. This kind of generational passing on of knowledge that allows people like Mark to be able to draw this kind of pride from it is broken. And unfortunately, I'm not here to give any answers. I don't know how it's going to happen. But unfortunately, I'm not sure how that could come back together. So I have one more thing to say. So I hope that through what I've been saying today has helped to show the importance of adding apprenticeships to our understanding of deindustrialized workplaces and how through looking through the eyes of former workers, we can understand these cultural losses and the implication that this has for workers in the past, workers in the present, and workers in the future. And how we can understand these kind of these attempts to share these work knowledges as attempts to kind of reinforce the dignity of communities like Medway that unfortunately have been lost.
You have been listening to a Working Class Studies Association conference panel focused on working class deindustrialization in the UK and the people it most affects. Panelists were Tim Strangleman, David Nettlingham, and Emma Pleasant, all from the University of Kent.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.